We're talking about challenges in the veterinary profession in rural areas on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The USDA, it tracks the shortage of veterinary services across the U.S. on a map. It runs the Veterinary Medicine Loan Repayment Program to help offset a portion of the debt to get a veterinary medicine degree. And in exchange, you work in a high-priority shortage area for 3 years. Do you have a shortage of vets in your community? Farmers, how often are you able to get a vet out to see your animals? Are you a veterinarian? What challenges do you face in your field? It's 800-642-1234 to join in. Dr. Megan Riccardi is a mixed practice veterinarian caring for large and small animals at Mayville Animal Clinic in Mayville, which is along the Rock River in Dodge County. Dr. Riccardi, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. I am very happy to be here.
Well, good morning. Let's walk in your shoes for a bit. What does a day in the life of a rural vet look like?
So I split my time between caring for small animals, mostly dogs and cats, and farm animals, mostly cows with some sheep and goat work. 3 days of the week, I come in at about 7:45 and I run surgery in the morning with some sick appointments and then healthy and sick appointments in the afternoon. And my role at this clinic in the large animal side of things is really just waiting for the sick animal calls to come in. We are lucky enough to have 7 doctors here. And so a lot of the large animal doctors run routine herd health in the morning. So I am around when farmers call with sick cows, goats, sheep, or chickens.
Okay, so you're basically on call there. And what happens then? How long might you drive to a farm to see these animals?
We have some clients that are as close as 5 minutes away from the clinic, but we usually don't go beyond an hour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What impact does that have on your day, not knowing what calls might come in, not knowing what type of animal you might be caring for?
It certainly keeps things interesting. The majority of our calls are cows that are either having issues calving or cows that are showing signs of illness after they've had their calves. So that's what I'm usually the most prepared for.
And you graduated last year in the pandemic. How has this been getting into your career in these times?
It has been an interesting time to learn how to be a doctor. So I've only ever functioned as a curbside veterinarian, which is kind of crazy, coming up on a year here. There's been good things and bad things about it, but for the most part, we are ready for clients to come back into the building. I want that face-to-face interface with the people that are trusting us with the care of some of their favorite animals.
I imagine, too, that's pretty cumbersome to do this work outside of, like, a clinic a normal office where you'd have all your tools at hand.
Yeah. Working as a large animal doctor, most of us have pickup trucks with what's called a vet box in the bed. It's just a large enclosed fiberglass container that holds our drugs, our equipment, things that protect us, things that allow us to function. So your organization and preparedness is definitely a big thing when you're out there battling, you know, some large animals and sometimes some interesting weather.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Megan Riccardi. Started her career as a veterinarian in Mayville, caring for large and small animals. We're discussing challenges in rural vet medicine with your insights as well. What do you want to know about being a veterinarian? Farmers, do you have easy access to a vet? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Riccardi, how did you land in a rural clinic? What led you to a rural area?
So I am lucky enough to be practicing in the county that I grew up in. I was born and raised in Eustis Ford, Ended up going to undergrad up in northern Wisconsin at UW River Falls, and then life took me to Missouri for vet school, so I got to come back home to practice. I had always planned on working on cows as well as small animals, and Mayville just really fit the bill. They have a great staff. We have a really good client base, and I get to do what I've kind of always wanted to do.
Was that always your intent to go back to the area where you're from, or have you ever imagined what it would be like to be a vet in a city, in an urban area?
There was a brief period of time where I was considering pursuing exotics medicine, so mostly zoos, and that would have obviously been in a city that can support a successful zoo. But at the end of the day, it was a little too competitive with less job opportunities than the average general mixed animal practitioner.
What did you see as far as job opportunities straight out of vet school?
So the majority of students that graduate, almost as high as 98% of veterinary students, graduate with an accepted job offer.
Okay.
And right now, there are a lot of jobs to come by, both in cities and in rural areas, anywhere from general practice to going into a specialty residency.
When you look at your class, did many of them go to rural settings, because there is this shortage of veterinary care in rural areas straight across the country?
I would say about 60% of my veterinary class was interested in mixed animal medicine, and the vast majority of those that were went to rural areas. You know, you got to go to where the cows are. And, you know, it was about a 50-50 split between those that wanted to work on just small animal or go through the specialty channels, or those that wanted to go out and do the everyday mixed animal work.
What about debt load? You know, how much student debt do veterinary students leave school with?
So much. It's one of the contributing crises to the mental health issue going on in our field. The average veterinary student, and this is based on a study out of the Journal of American Veterinary Medicine Association pretty recently, and the average just vet student debt is between $100,000 and $200,000. And then, you know, you're looking at a starting salary anywhere from $65,000 to $90,000. So the debt to income disparity is much more the problem than just the debt. You know, human doctors come out of med school with similar debt and have to make it through their internship and residency, but then look at a much higher salary right out of the gate. So it's really concerning for most of us in this field.
What is the, you know, how do you do to confront that? Because if your income, you know, isn't going up steadily or rising, you know, quite a bit after those first 3 years, that debt can be quite burdensome.
It is. It is not uncommon for veterinarians to pay off their student loans for 20 to 30 years. The biggest way to combat that is through loan forgiveness programs, most namely the state-based large animal forgiveness program, where they put you in an area of need for 3 years and then pay off a percentage of your debt. But the other sides to that are specializing, which leads to more debt but a higher income, or practice ownership, which, if you're in a good place, does allow for you to generate more income.
Dr. Megan Riccardi is with us, a mixed practice veterinarian based in Mayville. That's in Dodge County. Farmers, let's hear from you. How difficult is it to get a veterinarian out to your farm to care for a sick animal? Are you a farmer who has had to learn veterinary skills? Are there enough vets serving your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Dr. Riccardi here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about life as a rural vet and getting established in a practice in the pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A vet educator in South Dakota, it told the Wisconsin State Farmer recently that they worry about not attracting enough vet students who come from a farming background, that they won't practice in rural communities after they finish vet school. Are you a veterinarian? How did you decide where to start your career? Do you work in a rural area and drive long distances to care for large animals? Tell us about what you see, what you've experienced, 800-642-1234. Dr. Megan Riccardi is a mixed practice veterinarian in Mayville, completed her degree last year, and she's with us for 10 more minutes. Dr. Riccardi, you mentioned mental health, and veterinarians are under a lot of pressure, high stress levels in this job profession. Can you talk about that?
Definitely. So if any of you follow any veterinarians on social media, you may have seen the tag NOMV, and that stands for Not One More Vet, alluding to the suicide rates that we deal with as a profession. The CDC says that vets are anywhere from 2 to 3.5 times more likely to commit suicide than the general public, which is pretty daunting. And don't get me wrong, we have an important job. People are literally entrusting us with their pets' lives, and that's not lost on veterinarians at all. But it's a stressful job. The debt is really scary. We have occasional clients that are not kind to us. We're dealing with people and animals sometimes on the worst days of their lives. So I do ask that you guys just be kind to your veterinarian. We do care. And we could use a little bit of just general kindness from our clients.
What needs to change, do you think, to improve the working conditions?
Right now, everyone is pretty stretched thin. Coronavirus has increased the amount of people that have pets. Our shelters have been empty for the first time in almost forever, and there's just not enough doctors to go around right now. Clinics in Dodge County are booking out weeks in advance. So we are always looking for good techs and good assistants to help support us, and things that need to change in the education system to make becoming a doctor more affordable. And you know, we live in an age of social media where, you know, if you have a disagreement with somebody, those comments can really take a toll on both your mental health and the success of your business. So good communication on both ends of a veterinary client relationship is really important.
Going back to pet adoptions there, did you see a spike in pet adoptions affecting rural vet practices?
Absolutely. From the first time I started at this clinic last June, we were seeing a big increase in new puppies, new kittens, as well as new adopted adult animals. People were home. They thought it was a great time to introduce a new animal into their house and spend time with them. And surprisingly, we've been seeing more sick animals and more wellness appointments as well, in a time when we were kind of expecting financial constraints to decrease our client visits. It's actually been the complete opposite, and that's a nationwide phenomenon. Veterinary clinics are absolutely insanely busy right now.
And you also mentioned, you know, veterinary associates, vet techs. What are the challenges there of retaining vet techs?
Right now, there just seems to not be enough of them, and there are good programs that are popping up. It's a little bit more accessible to get into a technician program than it has been in the past, but there's just the demand is so high. We see that mirrored in human health with CNAs and nurses. There's just not enough people filling those gaps right now.
We're talking with Dr. Megan Riccardi, large and small animal vet in Mayville, as we look at the shortages in rural veterinary care. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Guy is joining us from Neillsville. Hi, Guy. What would you like to say?
Well, good morning. I'd just like to say I'd like to compliment Dr. Riccardi, and she's a very articulate speaker and, you know, laying this all out very well. I'm a veterinarian myself, over 30 years in practice, mostly livestock, mostly dairy in Wisconsin here, central Wisconsin, a lot of dairy farms. the whole landscape has changed in, over the course of my career. And what I mean by that is the number of dairy farms has declined very significantly. We used to have, when I graduated, there were probably 30, 40,000 dairy farms, and now there's 7,000. And so it's very difficult for veterinarians to have a clientele that's, you know, can support a good living. And I think that's, you know, the student debt and all that's important. But I think we need to think about, too, structurally how the livestock industry has changed with all the consolidation and the big operations. A lot of times don't use the veterinarians that much. Or when they do call, it's something that's really a very difficult case. And they'll actually have their own people on staff that do a lot of veterinary work.
Oh, I see. So they're really internalizing that in these larger operations. Dr. Riccardi, what have you seen by way of the consolidation of dairy and certainly the, you know, Wisconsin leading the nation in dairy farm bankruptcies?
I most definitely do not have 30 years of practice to back my thoughts here. So I love hearing from older, more experienced veterinarians, but I've seen the same thing. You know, in the last 2 years, we've almost lost half of the dairy farms that remained. And even here, we've seen a lot of our clients go bankrupt, sell off their animals, or there's also some people that are switching to raising beef. The inputs are a little bit lower, and it's just a slightly easier market sometimes. Mm. But it's scary. You know, watching clients that we care about go through financial struggles is difficult, and then we lose them as clients. So I definitely echo, you know, what we've been seeing here.
Yeah, and Guy mentioned being a veterinarian for decades, and the American Veterinary Medical Association says nearly 20% of vets are anticipating retiring this decade. What impact do you think this will have on the industry?
I think it's already changing how practices are changing hands. We're in a very interesting time where corporate-owned veterinary practices are becoming a rapidly increasing thing, which is not all bad. A lot of people hear that and think that we're handed a book of medicine and how to practice, and you stay in that binder, and that's not necessarily true. But it's different and interesting and offers a new approach. But I also have a lot of classmates that came directly out of vet school and went into clinic ownership. So for young doctors like me, the opportunities are out there, you know, as the generations above us are getting ready to retire. So some of it just has to be people willing to jump into that ownership or watch how the general trend of ownership may move to a corporate type of setup.
Hmm. What about specialties? You mentioned earlier about specialization. And is there a move away from these mixed large small animal practices?
It's hard to say if it's a move away or not, but the small animal landscape is expanding so rapidly. You can choose to go into an internship or a residency and specialize in emergency care, which allows for the 24-hour facilities that we now have some access to. You know, surgery is expanding as people are paying for orthopedic surgeries for their pets. You know, there's cardiologists. People are getting into paying for cancer treatment for their dogs and cats. So oncology is expanding, and all of those things allow us to do the really special parts, the really involved parts of small animal medicine. But unwillingly, the more people head into specialty, the less general practitioners we have. And as mixed animal and large animal doctors have even more financial struggle, that drives more people into small animal practice. So I do think we're seeing less people heading into large animal practice and by extension, rural practice.
I want to end here on work hours, Dr. Riccardi. May I ask how many hours a week you work or what your work-life balance is?
I feel like I'm pretty lucky here. Small animal days are anywhere from 8 to 10 hours. But large animal days have a lot of fluctuation. Sometimes it's a 6-hour day, sometimes it's a 12-hour day. My average week probably looks like 50 hours, and we share all of our duties between 7 doctors. So we're pretty frequent here, but there's a lot of people in this industry that work 60, 70, maybe even 80 hours a week. And the work-life balance is a real challenge. And that contributes to some of our struggles, I think.
And as we wrap up here, I'm wondering, do you have a pet?
I do. I have two cats and one dog.
Oh, that's great. And I'm sure that they get very good care having their owner be a veterinarian.
Yes. Sometimes that goes both ways. They either get wonderful care or I'm that person that forgets to give the monthly preventative. It's both when you have a doctor for a pet mom.
Dr. Riccardi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Megan Riccardi is a mixed practice veterinarian at Mayville Animal Clinic in Mayville. Coming up, we take a look at how Wisconsin's paper industry is trying to adapt and keep pace with marketplace demands. Do you work at a mill? Is it converting? Are you worried about it shutting down? 800-642-1234. We'll be back after a news update on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about getting back to the garden.
As the coronavirus pandemic has left more people stuck inside, a yearning to get back to nature has flourished. This is something writer Yialor of Eau Claire has been paying attention to over the last year. She tells us how she found solace in her family's garden and at the farmer's market, closely watching the fruits and vegetables.
About a month into the pandemic, in early spring, after what we hoped was the last frost, my mother and I bundled up to make our first trip out to the garden, where she divided the land and decided which crop would grow best where. After we finished planting the early spring vegetables, my mother said it was time to hoe or call the crops. Me di me thawo, me thaw me kao, thuo, ne chi thuo ne la chi ying dao. Little cucumbers, little squash, little beans, little potatoes, grow, for if you don't, you won't beat the weeds. So they grew, and indeed beat the weeds. Most days while out in the field, with my feet in the dirt and fingers tangled in the vines, I often forgot that the rest of the Chippewa Valley had paused. We continued to stake, to weed, and to find ways of keeping the crows away from the watermelons. Crows didn't know, or care, that we were living in a pandemic, and they would feast in our garden when we were away. Though my family had not sold produce at the farmers markets in years, our garden was surrounded by other Hmong growers who did. They were there before we arrived, and they were always the last to leave. Throughout the season, we watched as they tended to the land and hauled buckets of green beans and potatoes into the shade. When our watermelons ripened, my mother cut them open and handed out large slices to growers nearby who were gathering flowers for the next day's market. In return, I was gifted a summer bouquet and reminded that we exist for each other. I ran into some of the same growers when visiting various markets, and though they had seen fewer people come to shop, they were grateful that people came. For as long as people still came, they grew their produce and fed the valley. The crowd was certainly smaller than in previous summers, but the farmers' markets continued to offer an array of colorful produce, sweet berries, warm kolaches, and my new favorite, birch log birdhouses. At the end of the harvest, my family gathered and dried seeds, a practice that has preserved our history and culture over the years, and my mother filled each of our freezers with the summer's bounty. We gathered and boiled the Hmong corn, and we gave thanks to our ancestors for another good harvest. The Hmong New Year was not celebrated as a community after the harvest season. We did not gather for a ball toss or cultural performances. there was no need to worry about getting pepper sauce on traditional outfits or sticky fingers from spilled nava. However, all across the world, Hmong people celebrated in their homes, perhaps boiling corn too and filling chest freezers full of green beans, eggplants, and squash shoots. Though we did not anticipate a pandemic and the ways it would change our lives, I do know that my mother and I will return to the garden every spring. We will call the crops and ask them to grow, and we know they will hear us. They will answer.
That was Eau Claire writer Yia Lor on Calling the Crops with her mother. This story also appeared in Volume 1 magazine. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to the future of Wisconsin's paper industry and whether it can stay nimble in a volatile wood products marketplace. Recall about a year ago, people were stripping store shelves bare of toilet paper, hoarding that and other pandemic essentials. And now we see paper mills grappling with how to convert their processes to recycled products and more packaging like shipping boxes. All that online shopping is a boon to the corrugated industry. Do you work at a mill? Maybe you're a logger. What is your outlook for the paper industry in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234. Paul Fowler is director of the Wisconsin Institute for Sustainable Technology at UW-Stevens Point. Paul, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good morning, Kate. Glad to be back.
Good morning. We're monitoring that large fire that broke out at the idled Verso Mill in Wisconsin Rapids last night with multiple agencies responding. Of course, it's too early to know the cause, but what are you watching for?
Well, I think first and foremost is understanding that the people are safe, any folks who were in the area, but then understanding the assessment of the damage at the mill. We don't know that yet. It's early, but regardless, I think the incident will be at a level of complexity and further challenge to the tremendous efforts that are underway to transition the mill back into production.
Yeah, I mean, Verso Corporation did find a buyer for its Duluth mill just last week, ST Paper and Tissue. Do you see that there could be an option for Wisconsin Rapids?
Well, I think the consolidated cooperative has been making very strong overtures to Verso to purchase the mill. We've seen efforts in the state legislature by Governor Evers to provide loans, financial support to make the purchase a reality.
You had this detailed report about a couple years ago that stated pulp and paper is an $18 billion industry in our state, more than 30,000 workers. What is the state of the industry today?
Well, you know, the industry is, we're at a moment in time when the industry is changing really, really rapidly, like never before, I think. And so the challenge and the opportunity is how we respond to those dynamic changes. So things that are capturing the world attention and changing consumer behavior, like anti-plastic sentiment. You mentioned the growth in e-commerce, but also growth in food packaging and other high-performance functional unit packaging. Hygiene products, I mean, the tissue and towel sector is a great example of that. And then there's also this kind of mainstreaming of sustainability and circularity that we hear about, and global trade dynamics. All of those things are a sort of clarion calls for us to say, how does the industry in Wisconsin respond to all these opportunities? And so I think that you said that as very nicely as well. How does the industry stay nimble and respond, lead in those sorts of areas where there is increasing demand for fiber and paper products? So not declining demand, but changing demand, and demand that is changing really quickly.
But do you see it contracting here?
Well, I mean, we see white grades like printing and writing papers contracting. That's been happening for a while. There's nothing sort of new in that. We see, and that was kind of catalyzed by the COVID pandemic as retailers and brands sort of cut down on their advertising. Whilst there's no newsprint mills in Wisconsin, we saw demand for printed newspapers decreasing as people turn to online sources of news, for example. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we saw demand for things like e-commerce, right? You mentioned the corrugate boxes. The shipping boxes increased really, really significantly. Demand for at-home tissue increased at the same time that the away from home, that's the restaurants, the hotels, and so on, declined. And so there was kind of a shift in tissue demand in terms of the different grades that are available.
I was looking over Kimberly Clark's first quarter earnings in April, and its CEO said that its first quarter results reflect a volatile and challenging environment, and it pointed to commodity inflation and commodity headwinds. Can you read the tea leaves there? What inflation are you seeing?
Well, I think we're seeing in certain tissue grades a use of recovered paper for making those grades. And as offices and institutions closed because of the pandemic, the availability of recovered paper, not corrugate, but the white grades that come out of offices and out of schools and so on, really kind of slumped. And so there was a tightening of supply of that recovered paper. And so certain tissue towel mills were directed or had no option but other than to look at fresh or virgin fiber as part of their commodity materials. And so that sort of increased some sort of pricing in that respect.
You know, we've seen lumber prices soar, wood pulp, the cost of wood pulp is rising. What effect does that have on manufacturers, in mills here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so construction lumber, we've seen those sort of prices increase, but we haven't really seen the price of timber out of the forests increase. And that really is reflective of maybe an oversupply of pulpwood and so on. But demand for construction lumber, as folks have remodeled, as their housing market has increased, is really putting strain on sawmills that are producing those sort of construction grades of lumber. And so that's where that kind of disparity appears to come from.
Okay, so if you're a mill and you're seeing all these shifts in the industry and in your marketplace, and what is coming out of your paper mill might not be meeting what the marketplace demands are right now, what is the process like for converting your mill?
It's complicated, right? I mean, it's complicated and it's costly. And so we have examples of companies that have done that in Wisconsin. Midwest Paper, formerly Appleton Coated, converted its mill back in 2018 from making high-quality white grades to making recycled corrugate, and they're still doing that. But it takes time, it costs money. The ST Paper project in Duluth is projected to take over a year, maybe 2 years, and investments in the tens of millions of dollars. And tens of millions of dollars are really the sort of the cheaper end of the market. You're really talking about maybe hundreds of millions of dollars to do a conversion of a world scale plant.
So you're not only taking the mill out of production, you're also having to invest a whole lot of capital in order to change processes.
You're right. So there's Domtar, which has a presence in Wisconsin, and was recently acquired by Paper Excellence, a Canadian firm. They're converting a mill in Kingsport, Tennessee, from making white grade to recycled corrugate. Their budget for that is in the order of hundreds of millions, two years conversion time. And they laid off the workers who were making those white grades. And so you have this sort of 2-year hiatus at least when the mills are not producing.
We're discussing the challenges, the outlook for the paper industry here in Wisconsin with Paul Fowler. He heads up the Wisconsin Institute for Sustainable Technology at UW-Stevens Point. Do you live near a paper mill? How is it doing? Is it a good neighbor? Do you think companies take proper care of their waste? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Paul Fowler here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. We're looking at broader shifts in the paper industry, how Wisconsin is responding. Go back to 2018. This was an $18 billion industry employing more than 30,000 people at dozens of mills in our state. That was from a study by the Wisconsin Institute for Sustainable Technology led by Paul Fowler. And Paul stays with us for about 10 more minutes. You know, looking at the big companies, Georgia-Pacific, one of the largest manufacturers of pulp and paper, is set to be running its mills at full capacity, buying from smaller producers to keep up. International Paper, the nation's largest forest products company, up 2% year over year. Are smaller mills able to keep up with the huge companies?
Great question. So those companies that you mentioned really in commodities sectors. So International Paper is essentially a corrugate manufacturer now. Georgia-Pacific, a lot of tissue, a lot of towel, as well as the sort of the forest product side of things as well. So I think that the point of differentiation for smaller companies is being very, very sort of customer centric and using their scale, their smaller scale, to be nimble and to really produce custom products, working really closely, collaborating with their customers to develop really precisely the grades and products with the functionality that they need.
What does that mean, though, for small manufacturers who are trying to keep up with larger companies and you know, wondering, am I going to be bought out?
Yeah, so it means differentiate your products, I think, Kate. So really tune in to customers. It's kind of a fool's game, I think, to try and compete with the folks who are at the hundreds of thousands, millions of tons scale. And so mills that we've seen being successful with smaller scale assets are the ones who've differentiated their products, gotten into more specialty grades. It may be food packaging, it may be sort of industrial papers, but they've found a niche for themselves and are playing to those strengths where a smaller scale is more able to give them that sort of nimbleness that they need to be able to adjust grades quicker, to be able to make what their customers are really needing in a precise and high quality way.
Paul, how does the closure of one mill affect a community like a Wisconsin Rapids?
Well, I mean, we've seen really very, very starkly how the idling of the Verso mill impacted not just directly the 900 workers there, but also the economy of the town. Right, people don't go out to eat the same. The direct expenditures in the town are curtailed. But there's also the knock-on effects back up the supply chain as well. And we've seen organizations like the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association speak very eloquently and loudly about the impacts of that, the closure of that mill on small forest landowners, on haulers, on loggers, and so on. The amount of virgin timber that the Verso Wisconsin Rapids plant processed was just huge.
So there is quite a ripple effect, I think, is what you're saying.
Absolutely, a huge ripple effect.
We're talking with Paul Fowler, director of the Wisconsin Institute for Sustainable Technology at UW-Stevens Point, as we look at the state of the pulp and paper industry, what comes next, your insights as well, 800-642-1234. We heard from Bruce and Madison Culden couldn't stay with us. Bruce was curious, Paul, on what changes UW-Stevens Point has to make in the paper engineering program to stay competitive and keep up with the changing industry.
Well, I can't speak to the paper science department firsthand, but I can speak to it secondhand. I would say that the number of students that are educated there is pretty stable, if not slightly increasing, and the fundamentals of making paper have not changed, right? I mean, you need engineers with excellent capabilities, and the paper science and chemical engineering program is doing exactly that. They get a broad-based education. I think understanding more about the business of paper is something that everyone in that field, particularly students, could use to know more about. Really, the global business for paper, as I said at the start of this piece, is changing really, really rapidly. And having a finger on that pulse, I think, was really helpful in terms of understanding what's on the horizon. How do we respond and position ourselves for those sorts of changes that can happen very, very quickly? So being able to horizon scan, if that's a skill set that the student has, I think would be very, very valuable to be able to market.
What are the prospects there of exports in this industry, of the global marketplace, and the competitiveness of, you know, other manufacturers in other countries?
So in 2018, the United States as a whole was exporting recovered paper to China. So low value, but a pretty significant amount of material. And we were good at that, and China was a great customer for that material. I think the opportunity really revolves around not exporting low-grade resources, but value-added materials. So finished products or products that are ready to be converted. The challenge there then is really having that in-depth understanding of customer needs, cultural differences, and being able to respond to those in a really sort of quick and nimble way.
So nimble there being the word of choice, I think.
Right.
But what are you watching for now as we head out of this pandemic for what will happen to this industry?
Well, I think the sort of fundamental changes that have happened. Does everyone go back to the office as we did in sort of pre-pandemic era? What is the new focus on hygiene? How long lived will that sort of trend be? And what does that mean for paper? What about the whole sort of e-commerce space? How do we innovate our corrugate boxes in ways that reduce weight but still provide protection and allow us to pack multiple items in one box? So pre-COVID, the retail corrugate box was quite a different structure from what we have now when we have products delivered at home. We have sort of the loose fill, the void fill present within corrugate now, which was not so much of a thing pre-COVID. And so those sorts of innovations, hygiene, e-commerce, and then just a higher and higher demand for functional, high-performance packaging materials, whether it be for food or electronics and consumer goods and so on. I think there's a lot of scope there.
Paul,
go ahead.
Paul, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you are very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Paul Fowler, Director of the Wisconsin Institute for Sustainable Technology at UW-Stevens Point. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.